It's called Starry Eyes, and I guess one of the biggest hits by a power pop band that is largely unknown today called The Records, and chosen by our special guest on this edition of The Song Is You, Benjamin Patton. Ben, welcome.
A pleasure to be here, Bonnie.
The song is you.
The song is me. Yes, and The Records, I think they're pretty much a one-hit wonder. I came across that song because I used to go from my parents' house in Massachusetts to Georgetown back and forth the beginning and end of every semester. And my brother lived halfway down in Connecticut. So we'd stop off and we'd make mixtapes together. And this was the first mixtape I ever made with him.
My God.
And this was the first song.
So I think we're going back to the late 70s with this song, right?
I forget the exact year, but it definitely is a wildly, they're kind of a Monkees throwback, really.
Right, you know? Right. It's kind of head bopping,
yeah.
Power pop, right?
But they rock. And I was driving out to the Hamptons today it sounded like the song you ought to be playing when you're driving out to the Hamptons. I almost got a speeding ticket, actually.
And actually, we should mention, too, that Benjamin Patton has written a new memoir called Growing Up Patton, Reflections on Heroes, History, and Family Wisdom. And yes, he is of that Patton family. Your grandfather was George Patton, the general, the man, head of the Third Army.
Correct. Yeah. But he also had a son that was my father, Major General George S. Patton. And so the book is really about the two of them. In fact, it a bit more centers on my dad and their relationship and the wisdom that I and my generation picked up from them.
Would you call it a memoir?
Yeah, I'd say it's a memoir. I mean, I knew my father till, you know, he died 8 years ago when I was in my late 30s. But like any kid that loses a father at any age, you always leave a few conversations on the table. You know, you're just too much of a know-it-all or to ask him certain questions. And then so I went back to people that he knew and worked with, some relatives, some colleagues, some friends throughout his career that knew him at critical times in both of their lives and asked them about him. And along the way, I picked up the wisdom that they learned from their fathers and mothers in their families. And so it turned out to be quite a fascinating journey.
A journey for you indeed, right?
Certainly, yeah, it really was.
New discoveries about yourself, about your dad, about your grandfather, yeah?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I discovered, I would say, I mean, there are a number of things, but I used to feel pretty badly about the fact that I didn't go in the military. I had long considered going to the Naval Academy, never the Army, but the Naval Academy. And at the last minute, I kind of blinked. And I think my father seemed disappointed because I think it wasn't so much that he wanted someone to follow in the family business, but that I think he thought I'd be good at it. And years later in writing this book, I reflected on it and I realized that I think what he really wanted to happen was for me to just find my authentic path. And I found a picture that's now on the cover of the book. I found a picture. It's the first picture I have inside the book as well. And on the back, I found a business card, and it says, I'll show it to you.
Yep.
And it says, on the back, it had a little business card written
about
on my
dad. About the vocation and avocation.
And it said, here's a member of your family uniting his vocation with his avocation, something everyone should strive to do, love dad. Usually he signed it, love GSP. But that was really true. I think he wanted me to find and others to find their authentic selves. And hopefully now, given the work I'm doing that we'll talk about later, you know, he'd be happy.
Yeah, because you ended up, you're a filmmaker. And you work with you do work with veterans now, right?
I do. I teach film camps with a colleague based out of Denver in the summer to teenagers. But then I've taken that approach, which is essentially trying to harness these incredible digital tools that we have now, you know, laptops with video editing and computers.
Ben's got his iPad
and,
here, right?
Yeah, and the digital video cameras and so forth. And every phone made now has video on it. And applied that approach of teaching narrative to soldiers struggling with post-traumatic stress.
Mm. I wonder what your grandfather would think of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, he didn't really have any idea what it was, first of all. And if anything, reacted pretty badly to it. I mean,
yeah.
He's famous, and it frankly shortened his career and took him out of the Normandy planning altogether, having slapped two soldiers really at the height of the Sicily campaign in the summer of 1943.
People remember this in the film that Josie
right.
Scott portrayed.
And there were actually two incidents about a week apart, and one was portrayed in the film, and he really had no clue about it. My father sort of had the same, similar incident in Korea,
sure.
And I suppose you talk to veterans and they can say it's understandable. A lot of times it's trying to give the person back their sense of self-esteem and pride and get back out on the battlefield and fight for your brothers, but I think neither one of them had an understanding about it. And so I would, while they both care deeply about the troops, hopefully this work, it feels redemptive and it feels like something's come full circle and that I get to fill in this gap now in my family a bit.
Does it make you feel less, or did you feel guilty that you didn't go into the military?
At the time I did, but now that I've circled back, gotten it, and come back to the family legacy on my own terms, I think everybody that really grows up, if you will, and hopefully I'm starting to grow up at 46, you have to go away from, when you have a big family like this, you have to go away from that legacy and come back to it on your own terms. And I feel like through this work with soldiers now, and I'm very supportive of veterans in general, as are all the members of my family, I feel like it has come full circle, and so I can meet that legacy on my terms.
And same in writing this book, right? In a sense, full circle?
I think so. I had the help of a classmate of mine from Georgetown who's a much better writer than I am, and it would be a pop-up book if it wasn't for her. But it really does have my voice, and it does feel that it's helped me bring things full circle and sort of close that chapter in a healthy way.
And what chapter has music played in your life? How much of a chapter?
Well, my dad's graduation present from his mother, one of his presents, was a Gibson hollow body with an electric pickup that my brother now has, who's a wonderful guitarist who lives in Darien, Connecticut. And so he always described himself as a three-chord man. So we played a whole lot of Harry Belafonte and Johnny Cash. And
growing
up.
Some blues, maybe.
Hey, later on, he took up the banjo, and he really was a very musical guy, and he also had a big personality, very much like the George C. Scott persona in Patton, where my father would walk into a room with his shock of white hair and his white stars, and he would really take the, you know, just suck up all the energy in the room in a very positive way.
So George C. Scott was actually more similar to your dad than your grandfather, in a sense,
in
right?
the way they looked and sounded, certainly. Yeah. Certainly.
Because your grandfather, you said, had a high voice.
He did. He had kind of a
high-pitched voice.
Oh, we're going to get those Germans. We're going to, you know, knock the socks
no.
off. We're going to kick their butt. Yeah, my
not
dad
General
was more.
Patton.
Yeah,
no.
But he was still pretty tough.
Well, yeah.
But my dad was really had that towering voice. And so while there was no violence in our house and no corporal punishment of any kind, just the threat of it was always there. Like, Ben, if you don't get to your room, there are going to be consequences. And with that towering voice, I would move very quickly.
So you never touched?
No, corporal punishment?
All. Not
at all.
Yes.
It was great.
Cool
it was great
that.
Santini without the abuse. Nobody bounced a basketball off my head.
We're here with Ben Patton, and he's brought his guitar along, too. So maybe I can twist your arm and get you to play a little bit. What do you think? A little
sure,
later
we'll
on?
We'll play a little later on, for sure.
But first, Martin Sexton.
Right. I would just say that I love Martin Sexton, and later on I want to play one of my favorite songs of his, but I just love the idea that a short little 5'3", or 5'4", sorry, Martin, if you're more than 5'4", but that Marty Sexton, a little white guy, could play one of the more branded songs in history, Prince's Purple Rain, and he's awesome live. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine has produced several of his albums, named John Alasia, a classmate of mine from Georgetown, and this is just a fantastic cover that he does, and he usually does it as an encore.
Let's hear.
London when they calls you when it's all over. Them when they calls you when it's pain. Only on a one time see you laughing. Only wanna see you laughing in the purple rain, purple rain, purple rain, purple rain, purple rain, purple rain, purple rain. Only wanna see you laughing in the purple rain. I wanna be your wicked lover. Only wanna be some kind of friend. Yeah, yeah. Woman, I could never steal you from another. It's such a shame that our friendship had to end. Purple rain honey, I know that these times are changing. And I know it's time we all reach out for something new. And that means you too. You say you wanna leave her, but you can't seem to make up your mind. Maybe we ought to close it and let us guide you through the purple rain, purple rain, purple rain. Yeah. Purple rain.
Martin Sexton recorded live. Ben Patton, our guest on the song, is you. Do you know where this was recorded live?
I really don't. I know the first time I heard it, I was sitting at WFUV Fordham University.
That's okay. We love FUV.
And he was playing there live, and then people started going Purple Rain, and he played it as his encore.
Unbelievable.
And it was, as soon as you heard those first few licks, you knew. It was Purple Rain.
Can you play him?
Oh, my God. No, I can't. After hearing that, I can't get anywhere near Martin Sexton after playing that. You know?
And he comes, since we're recording this, of course, here at WPPB Studios on the east end of Long Island. Martin Sexton comes, I think, annually to the Stephen Talkhouse.
He does.
You've heard him there, yeah?
I've heard him about 10 times,
How often have you been out to the east end?
I come out a fair amount. Yeah? I've got friends, in East Hampton, Southampton, and Amagansett, and all
How
around.
About your dad?
I'm just sort of a carpetbagger. You know, I'm a vagabond. I just stay wherever they'll have me.
Was your dad ever out here? Your
Not
grandfather?
Not really much. No? My father, we sailed a lot. We sailed a lot up and down the East Coast. He was a big sailor, yeah, despite being in the Army, which is why I started to fall in love with the Navy at an early age. But he hated going into port. We'd go into, you know, Block Island, and he'd say, like, you know, we'd get there at 9 at night, and he'd want to leave before dawn, you know. So he liked the minimal, you know, encounters with the, you know, with the people on the On the shore.
He just wanted to be out.
When he went to sea, he wanted to be at sea.
Mm-mm-mm. What about Growing Up Patton, since that's the title of your book? Having a name like that, was that a blessing, a curse? Was it a mix? I mean, you talk, I think, a little bit about all of that.
I mean, in the end, it certainly nets out to be a positive. I mean, I love being in this family, but it certainly has its burdens. When I look at it in comparison to my father's burden growing up with the name, it doesn't even compare, though. I mean, he, as you may know, graduated from West Point 6 months after his incredibly famous father died in 1945. So,
and you never knew your grandfather.
I didn't know my grandfather, but I guess my point is that my father was struggling to get through West Point, and we talked about some of the letters that we can look at, and they communicated by every week. Here, my grandfather's in Sicily, Africa, Sicily, and Western Europe, you know, commanding hundreds of thousands of men, and my dad's trying to struggle through professors that don't know anything about Napoleon and women.
Dating women. Yeah.
And trying to keep from flunking math again, because they both flunked math and had to do an extra year at West Point. But when my father graduated 6 months after his father was killed as a result of a freak car accident in Germany, the day before he was to come home, 6 months later, my dad walked through graduation in 1946 at West Point, and an old veteran came up to him and said, "You'll never be the man your father was, but congratulations anyway." Mm. So when I compare my own sort of search for myself with my father's decision to go in the military, just, you know, it's nothing. He really dealt with a great legacy that he had to face, and I think he did manage he really did a great job of living up to it, I think.
Well, what's interesting is your grandfather, you say in your book, did not insist that your father go into the military necessarily, right? He did not.
I think he didn't. I think deep down he may have wanted him to, but my father loved it so much, and I think that's why I decided not to go in, because while I, interestingly, in my 40s now, I get up early, you know, and I'm pretty good with a shotgun, you know, and I know a lot about military history, and I've just written a book about military history. But even so, at the time, at 17, I just wasn't really ready to make a 10-year commitment to go to the academy and then do 5 or 6 years.
Since we're taping this around the 4th of July, how do you feel around military holidays? What does that mean for you?
It's a great question, because I've been giving a lot of talks lately around the book, and I gave one on Memorial Day and on D-Day, and I'm talking this week in the Hamptons, actually, a few different places. And I always like to point out that that these days, including Veterans Day, when we think about soldiers, they're really not meant to be like Mother's Day. Well, oh, it's Mother's Day, we got to think about our mother. They really should be reminders that we need to be thinking about these men and women every day. Mm. And you know, over the next several years, this is quite a statistic, 350,000 men and women each year over the next 5, 6, 7 years will be getting out of the military and trying to join the civilian workforce. And hundreds of thousands of them will probably, let's say 15, 20, 25% of them may have some level of post-traumatic stress. And we need to keep our eyes on these folks and help them, because this isn't like a world war. You know, in World War One and World War Two, the entire country was invested in what was going on. Here you have less than 5% of Americans are connected with this war.
Yeah, those were the days where they were good wars, right?
Right. Now it's not like Vietnam. It's just that people are focused on the economy and their own pocketbook, and they're not really, they can look the other way. But my point is that these are people literally that are willing, that have been willing and volunteered to take a bullet for you and me. And regardless of what we think about the politics of it, there are not that many people that are supportive of us staying over there any longer. But regardless of where you're on that, you cannot forget that these are people that volunteered to take a bullet for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to look out for them.
And you're looking out for a young one now, so a next generation Patton, yeah. Right?
That's
Tiger
true.
Is your son?
I have a
son's?
3-year-old named Tiger Patton.
Love it.
I mean, come on. We needed a Tiger in the Patton family, I thought. That was about
Tiger
time.
Patton. And so. You got your guitar in hand. I managed to convince Ben Patton to play a little bit for us.
Well, I'm a hack guitarist, and
my great friend,
roommate from college, Chris Mack, has taught me everything I know. But I will tell you this. There's a song that my brother Bob taught me long ago called City Girls by J.J. Cale. And J.J. Cale wrote a bunch of songs for Clapton. And so I love this song, and I'll play you a couple stanzas the way it's really written, and then I'll show you how I've changed. It's sort of like writing my own song, only not. I changed the lyrics for Tiger. So this is sort of like, well, city girls, they all right. They just want you for the night. When the morning comes to dawn, city girls, they all gone. What's poor boy gonna do if he wants a girl like you? Can't afford no diamond rings, all those other fancy things. And then I changed the lyrics for Tiger. Well, Tiger is so cool, he ain't nobody's fool. Keeps you up all night, but in the morning he's all right. What's daddy gonna do if he wants a kid like you? Can't afford no private schools with all those complicated rules.
Nice. Thank you, Ben Patton.
So he loves that stuff. He's very musical.
Is he? Yep.
Oh, my God. He really is.
And he's 3 years old, yeah?
He's 3 years old. I've taught him how to take a bow after he performs. He plays a little harmonica. I have a whole song called Tiger on the Harmonica. He plays like, Tiger on the Harmonica. You know, and so we have a blast.
That's great.
He's a great kid.
And what do you think about him? What if he grows up and wants to be in the military?
I think it's a choice that everyone has to make. There are a lot of advantages to being the military. You know, see the world, really. You know, there's a lot of camaraderie. My father loved the soldiering as much as anything. Mm-hmm. Just the camaraderie, being part of a team. You get a command at a very early age, particularly in the Army. You know, you're commanding troops. You learn great leadership skills. Yes, you have to go in harm's way. And the difficult part about it is that you have a president or superior that's telling you what to do, which is perhaps the part I had the most difficulty with. You know, I didn't want to get up in the morning at 6, you know, when my father came in to go duck hunting or sailing or send me off to school, and I had trouble with that. But I think in retrospect, it might have done me a little good to have, you mm-hmm. know, 4 years of somebody kicking my butt around and making me press my pants and shine my shoes.
Because it's something you had to do. Remember that moment in Patton, the film? Did you like it, by the way? Did you like the film?
Well, it came out when I was 5,
yeah.
And it was really my first impression of my grandfather. Like, hey, I was just a moviegoer. He won 8 Academy Awards, and I got to meet George C. Scott when he came by our house, and it was cool.
It was cool. But remember that scene that Omar Bradley says, the difference between me and you, George, is that I do this because I get paid to do it. I was trained to do it. You do it because you love it.
Yeah, and I think that's true in a micro sense, in that my grandfather, again, loved the soldiering, loved the camaraderie, loved the tactics and the game of war. But I do think they sort of, it was a bit simplistic in implying that he loved war. And I think nobody really that knows war really loves war.
I think he didn't either. He didn't.
I mean, nobody, you know, my grandfather even had a quote that said, if you're not afraid of the consequences of war, you know, you're either a fool or you're just insane. You know, I mean,
So he wasn't insane, although some people might have thought.
No, but he did. He was all about putting himself in harm's way and leading from the front. You never saw him either in the movie or in any of the documentary footage of him moving backwards through the troops. He was always going forward. In fact, he had a pilot's license so that he could fly back or have himself flown back to his command post at the end of the evening. But he'd always be seen in his command car going forward. My father was the same way. And he called it visible personality. He called it putting yourself at the critical point in a battle.
Like George Washington did it, right?
Yeah. And sometimes my dad would land in a landing zone where there may or may not be a firefight happening, just to see if there was any action. And the troops loved that. And he used to say that. And my father was also quite famous for insisting on wearing white insignia in the field with fatigues. Normally, you wear your stars or whatever in black.
So they blend in a bit.
So they blend in, so you don't stand out. Well, my father liked to wear white insignia when he became a general in the field, and he was interviewed about that. And they said, why do you do that? And one of the reasons is, he says, because because I want to give the enemy a target, and I have disdain for their accuracy of fire, and I want him to know that. But he says that with a kind of a smirk, so uh-huh. It's bravado, but the troops love it. And when I was a kid, we would go to mess halls, you know, that he was commanding as part of his 20,000-man division. And, you know, the general shows up with his kid at 6 in the morning eating the scrapple and the grits and the fried eggs. And on the one hand, the food gets better really quickly, and the service gets a lot better really fast. But at the same time, the troops love it. He sits down there with his tray, and we're eating with him. How are you doing, soldier? Yep. You getting good food?
How many star general was your dad?
He was a two-star general.
Two-star? And your grandfather's four,
was
right?
A four-star.
Eventually four.
Eventually four.
Yeah. We're here with Ben Patton on The Song Is You. More music. How about Laurie McKenna?
Well, I just love Laurie McKenna. I mean, she's got four kids. I think she lives south of Boston. She's right. Married to a plumber. And she's just like my rock star. And I love people like her and Martin Sexton, who aren't as famous, but they could just go toe-to-toe with any musician in the world. And she's writing songs for Faith Hill and things like that. But this was a song I had a relationship that had great promise, and it ended up not working out. But this was a song that was kind of our song at the time. And I just love this song because it's very hopeful about relationship.
Witness to Your Life, it's called.
Someone was crying and the bells rang. Then I don't remember a thing. You were talking, but the words somebody else. Someone said kiss her, and so you did. I was smiling like a little kid. You kissed my teeth and then we both hid inside each other's arms. All you really need is someone to be here. Someone who never lets you disappear.
To Your Life, and we're witnessing Ben Patton's life by music, and in this case with Laurie McKenna's song. So reflecting on a relationship gone wrong, isn't it amazing the power of music and songs to help you through or guide you through parts of your life?
It is. And some of these other songs we're going to get to speak to that, I think. But for sure.
Laurie McKenna. And let's move on to the next one. This is one called Sideways, and you were telling me about this exchange.
Well, we did this thing which probably gets you in trouble if you did it nowadays. But, you know, a friend of mine named Scott Kinneman, who I also work with and who knows a lot about music, he's a filmmaker in Denver. He gave me this idea of doing a burning circle. And so you get 12 friends together. It's very simple, and not on the beach. Although that's another version. Is that the one you've been?
Right,
you were in a different
there.
Burning
yeah,
circle,
yeah,
Bonnie.
Yeah,
I think. I'd like yours sounds more interesting. But anyway, but each month, one of the 12 people makes a mixed tape or mixed CD, and sends it to the other 11 folks, and it's called a burning circle. And so you really learn a lot about new music. And one friend of mine, and people come up with their different themes. Mine, when I did mine, mine was called Half Covered, so they were all covers, like the one we heard at the beginning, Purple Rain. And this other friend of mine did duets. His name's Jamie Robinson from Philly, and his was all duets. He had like, you know, Johnny Cash and Joe Strummer, you know, doing Redemption songs and things like that. And then this other one, Sideways, Citizen Cope and Santana, was just such a cool song. And it's amazing how certain artists, particularly guitarists like Mark Knopfler and Clapton, and of course Santana, that you. It's just amazing they can play the same instrument as someone else, and you know it's them.
You know it's them, exactly.
So we can take a listen to that. I think it's a great song.
And it's so bluesy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Citizen Cope and Santana with Benjamin Patten on The Song Is You.
You know it ain't easy for these thoughts to leave me. There's no words to describe it in France or in England. 'Cause diamonds they fade, flowers they bloom, and I'm telling you, these feelings won't go away. They even knocking me sideways.
Called Sideways, and that's you can always tell Santana's sound.
It's
unbelievable,
so cool.
Unmistakable. And Citizen Cope, this is his own tune, actually. Right. Sideways, it's so bluesy. You like R&B? You like a little bit of that?
I really like the singer songwriter types. Yep. You know, the with their sort of spare. And you know, my friends, they the ones that have heard these choices too. They and the songs I like to play, they're
did
always
you,
like you're
you
slit
these?
Your wrists. Or you're like a slit your wrists. You know, music effects.
Did you
know,
run these by friends in choosing these?
They said, oh, there's that slit your wrist music again. You know, thank God you don't have suicidal tendencies.
Actually, speaking of which, we're going to turn next to a pretty powerful song and from a film that was unbelievable with Sean Penn.
Yeah.
And tell me the name of the actress.
Oh, Susan Sarandon.
Susan Sarandon.
And it's a powerful film, yeah. Very dark, and I believe it was Tim Robbins' debut, directorial debut. And
when did it come out, Ben?
Gosh, you know,
15 years ago, was it, maybe?
Probably in the late 80s,
exactly. Late 80s, yeah. Dead Man Walking, it's called. Yeah.
I think it might have been around 1995. I'm not exactly sure, but right around then. And but anyway, The Long Road at the end, everyone knows that this is a story about the character of Sean Penn that had definitely committed murder, was guilty, but he met this sister... Was it Sister Helen Prejean or Sister
Prejean? Yeah, right.
And basically, she wanted to him to experience some sort of grace before
redeem
himself. And in the final scene, I'll never forget when the guy's saying "Dead Man Walking," and he goes down there, you know, to the electric chair, and they start playing this song. And she looks at him right as the song starts and says, "I want the last face you see to be the face of love." And it's a dark song, but it's Eddie Vedder, and I can never pronounce his name. The Indian
Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan.
I love that you
He's
know
from
what
Pakistan.
You're talking about.
He's from Pakistan. Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's dark, but I find myself a lot of times driving on, when I've had some difficult nights, I've driven out to like Robert Moses Highway, you know, on Fire Island in the middle of the night, and just cranking this and listening to it. Mm. And I don't know. It just works for me.
Eddie Vedder and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. I love the combination of this Pakistani singer and singing in his own language and Eddie Vedder and The Long Road.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Eddie Vedder's voice is like I was speaking about the guitarist. You know, you just cannot mistake his voice.
You cannot, yeah.
For anyone else.
Pearl Jam, of course, Eddie Vedder. And The Long Road and Benjamin Patton on the song is you. It is a long road. It was a long road for your grandfather, your father. We were just talking about what it takes to be who they were, those military men, generals leading armies, leading other men and women. in their case, just men. But I was saying to Ben that when Patton, the film, came out, a lot of people objected to it because they claimed it was glorifying war. And how do you respond to something like that?
I mean, there's a certain amount of glory that one sort of has to. Sometimes they associate with war when they're in it because it's kind of maybe what gets them through, particularly a leader like my father who has to come off to his soldiers as though he's invincible so that he can get them to move forward. You know, they move the ball forward. The tricky part is, and I actually saw this in The Road Less Traveled, that book, Scott Peck book a long time ago, where they talked about the difference in the two kinds of leaders that are the ones that just look at men like, you know, like just pieces of sausage, and they just, okay, I'm going to lose a third of my men today in this battle, and that's just the way it is, and they don't think twice about it. But the other ones, the really strong leaders, are the ones that know where the chips will fall. They know that they're going to have losses. They feel them deeply. My father wrote a letter to every single person that died under him in Vietnam, but they still move forward knowing that. And kind of on a lighter note, my dad used to say, you know, both he and his father used to say, you know, there are two kinds of leaders. There's persuasive leaders like Robert E. Lee or others like that, or there are an Eisenhower perhaps, and there are obtrusive leaders like Grant and Patton and MacArthur. And he said, guess which one I am.
You know? So, speaking of that, you want to read a little something from the book about leading? Is this about leaders?
Yeah. In fact, it's funny. I just opened the page to that very quote where my grandfather said, the two types of successful soldiers, the ones who get on by being unobtrusive or those who get on by being obtrusive. I am of the latter type and seem to be rare and unpopular, but it's my method. You have to choose a system and stick to it, you know? And then otherwise, speaking about the courage aspect, my grandfather wrote to my father on D-Day. Now, keep in mind, my grandfather had slapped a soldier in 1943, two soldiers. He'd been pulled completely out of the D-Day plannings, even though he had more experience nautically than anyone. He had sailed the Pacific, taught himself to navigate, and had landed on both Sicily and North Africa in amphibious landings. So he was pretty frustrated.
But he was being punished.
He was being punished. And later, as D-Day approached, he became the decoy for the thing. So he'd actually had a positive, but he would rather have been leading the thing. And but see, after Sicily, he went from being Bradley's superior to working for Bradley. And Bradley didn't want him involved in the war at that point. So on D-Day, he had a lot of extra time on his hands. And he wrote my father a 2,000-word letter at West Point, and which I've reproduced in the book. And it's one of the few letters that has been published, but it's published in its entirety here. And it says, all men, writing to my dad, he says, all men are timid on entering a fight, whether it is the first fight or the last fight. All of us are timid. Cowards are those who let their timidity get the better of their manhood. You will never do that because of your bloodlines on both sides. Mm. Now, my father was courageous under fire, no doubt. But, I mean, others, I think it's, that just reveals the ignorance he had about things like post-traumatic stress. And the term post-traumatic stress disorder didn't even exist until well after Vietnam. So I just don't think they understood that. And that's why it makes me happy that I'm doing the work I am now, which doesn't in any way denigrate the service of soldiers. But when you see your friend have his arms and legs blown off right in front of you by an IED, or imagine the guy in Rome that's, you know, in some battle and he sees his friend split in half by an axe, and then he's got to walk 200 miles the next battle drenched in blood with no one to talk to. You know, these guys have post-traumatic stress. And I ran into an active duty colonel, tough, grizzled warrior at a talk a few months ago, and he said, hey, don't kid yourself. He said, everybody has it. It's just a question of how crippling it is to each of us.
Hey, there you go. And how obvious it is, how much you let it show, I guess. Right. It's all part of the journey, in the journey, right?
Right.
We're all in the journey.
Certainly, and that brings up, wonderful segue, Bonnie, that brings up one of my all-time favorite songs from Martin Sexton, which I've loved for years and years and years. And one time a friend set up a surprise birthday party for me at Martha's Vineyard, and my friend John Alasia, who produced several of his albums, had him open with that song at the, I think it was at the, was it the Tin Roof or something, or some place in Martha's Vineyard. And he played in The Journey. And this may be about his own recovery from whether it's alcoholism or other things he was dealing with. But it does, for me, resonate in terms of the work I'm doing with soldiers, both in terms of their isolation and the craving to talk to and relate to someone else, to relate their story to someone else. And I think that's a bit what this is about.
Sure.
Metal. with an old friend last night at a cup of coffee. We talked about all the things that have been going on. We talked about the old days and talked about the new days. Talking just about anything but what was really going on. Long minutes they slowly passed us by. A tension in the air, I could cut it with a knife. Staring out the window and gazing into the rain. Suddenly he called my name and he looked me in the eye. He said, I don't know where I'm gonna know. One long road I've been trailing just to come see you again. I don't know where I'm going, I just don't know where I've been. And it seems to find me some trouble, and right now I could sure use a friend. Met up with an old friend last night, had a cup of coffee.
And we talked about all the things that had been going on.
In the Journey. Martin Sexton is your man, Ben Patton.
He's a titan in my eyes.
Oh, my God. That's beautiful. So The Journey is all in this new book Benjamin Patton has written, Growing Up, Patton Reflections on Heroes, History, and Family Wisdom. A couple of quick takes, not just about your father and grandfather, but other heroes that you talk about in their lives, right?
Absolutely. And one of them that's, that people find very striking is that my father and the son of Erwin Rommel, who was considered my grandfather's storied battlefield rival, yeah, the Desert Fox.
Magnificent bastard. I read your
book. Exactly. He did. His son was named Manfred Rommel, and who was a teenager when his father was forced to commit suicide at the hand of Hitler in the fall of 1944. And I have an interview of him telling me that story. It's wonderful. And he's the subject of a chapter in the book. But what's great is that my grandfather, I think, always wanted to meet Rommel because they're very chivalrous about this. You know, they fight, they try to kill each other. When they're done, they want to meet and go have a beer, you know, and talk about it. And my dad used to try and meet people that he had battled against, you know, the commanders of the Vietnamese forces he tried to battle against in Vietnam afterwards. And he tried to set up a meeting with them sometimes, and, you know, because that's just the way they were.
Did he ever go back to Vietnam after?
He didn't.
He never did.
He wouldn't have minded it, but he just didn't get back there. But anyway, so after the war, my grandfather, of course, having died a year after Erwin Rommel in the car accident,
By the way, was that deliberate?
The family investigated it, and really... Okay. Nobody was going to pick off my grandfather in the fall of 1945. He had been set aside. We weren't planning to invade Russia. I just think it was a freak car accident. He was doing 20 miles an hour, and he was the only one hurt in the accident. It was just one of those things. But in many ways, some people would say that he died at the right time. I mean, of course, I would love to have met him personally, but he was incredibly famous. Then he was sort of set aside after the war, didn't get sent to the Pacific or back to, West Point or something.
Another guy over there. Right.
There was another guy, another prima donna over there. And then suddenly he's in this accident. He's on the cover of every magazine and every newspaper in the world for 2 weeks. And then he dies. And that's part of the reason why he has this somewhat outsized legend, I would say.
And here is your father, his son, going over to meet the son of Rommel.
Well, most of the U.S. troops are now based in Stuttgart, and Rommel lived in Stuttgart. The son was a bureaucrat. In the 70s, he became the mayor of Stuttgart, incredibly popular, has a lisp. You know, his father never thought he'd make a very good soldier because he said, you have a lisp, you know, and he did. He was kind of a rebel. But he's a wonderful statesman, and he could have probably been chancellor of Germany, but he just liked local politics. He said that politics at a local level is about getting things done. It's about solving problems. Politics at a national level is like an opera house where everybody just wants to be heard. And he was a wonderful mayor. And so my father was stationed there. We were stationed there two or three times in my lifetime, and we would go over to their home after they met. They became great friends. And we would go over there on Christmas Eve every year because, lo and behold, my dad and Manfred Rommel were both born on Christmas Eve. Mm. So imagine going over there and they're trading memorabilia from their parents and from their fathers. And, you know, there's a battle map or a star or whatever.
The Desert Fox meets Old Blood and Guts.
No, I mean,
right?
People think it's strange, but really it makes a lot of sense many ways, because it felt like when we walk into their home, it felt like we were going into one of...
Because they were massive rivals. But as you say, they respected one another.
They did.
So
they had a lot of integrity.
Right. Yep. And we forget Rommel was not a Nazi, correct?
Correct.
He was not. He was a member of the German army.
He didn't even believe in voting. I mean, in those days, the military didn't vote. So but that was much to his, you know, demise.
I mean, they didn't even put swastikas on tanks, right? Because it was a political statement. The swastika was not a military statement. It was a political statement.
No, but
it was the Iron Cross that they used.
Yeah, and particularly as soldiers like Rommel started to learn about what was happening. You know, they wouldn't want their children involved in that. But again, he was not for Hitler at the end. He just didn't believe in taking him out by assassination because he was afraid that if it didn't work, it would make him even more powerful. Or even if it did work, it might make him a martyr.
Yeah.
So he was more interested in a battlefield surrender of all the troops that were under his command, which is what he intended to do.
And then he
would have no choice. But 3 days before the bomb plot happened, Rommel was strafed by a Spitfire and his command car was destroyed, his driver was killed, and he had multiple skull fractures. So he was actually unconscious when von Stauffenberg was bombing the bunker, you know. And so, but anyway, he was killed, and my father and Rommel became great friends. And
is your father's story, does that belong on the big screen? I mean, I'm picturing it.
Well, I've been in the promise of, I've been in the process of pitching a documentary based on the evolution of this family over several generations.
Wow.
And
we're
quite well known also for not throwing anything out. I mean, we still have the bloody shirt tail and the piece of shrapnel that went through it at the battle of, I think it was the
in Civil War,
the battle of the third battle of Winchester in 1864, where it pierced my great grandfather George the First's abdomen and killed him. And so we have the shrapnel and the shirt tail, and so we don't throw anything out. But we also have years and years of home movies.
Yeah. And there are never before ever published letters in this book. We should tell our listeners that.
Yeah,
it's called Growing Up Patton. And it's Benjamin Patton. And let's just really
And you can
really
find,
quick,
of course, the book. You can find it anywhere.
Anywhere,
Amazon.
Sure.
And there's a website which has a lot of some of the interviews and a lot of different things up on it, and links to other places where you can see clips of home movie footage at growinguppatton.com.
Growinguppatton.com. You got a couple of other websites, too, including your project, right?
Sure. I'd just like to mention that I've been doing these I Was There Media, or I Was There filmmaking workshops, and there's a website, iwastheremedia.org. And I've now actually gone so far as to set up a nonprofit organization called the Patton Veterans Project that'll house these workshops, where we actually put a camera in the hands of soldiers that have dealt with traumas. And it's no accident that the book is actually framed by the foreword at the beginning by Bob Woodruff, who, as you may know, was the heir to the anchor chair of Peter Jennings when Peter Jennings died. And then a month or two later was blown up by an IED and lost a third of his skull. So on the front end, framed by that, and on the back end by a discussion of some of the work that I've been doing with soldiers. So it's very exciting, and
congratulations.
I'm just happy to be here. And I guess we can finish up with this.
Well, this is the big finale, and this takes you to your dad, right? Les
sure.
Mis?
Really, the dad is my dad is he's really just a titan in my eyes. He's a guy that I just long to see again.
Your son
again.
Is
I
a tiger
him.
In your eyes, and your dad's a titan.
Something
in your
like
eyes.
That. Yeah. Yeah, you could put that rather. That's poetically done. That's nice. You'd fit right in my family of poor man's Kiplings. But
thanks, I think.
But anyway, so yes, when we would drive from place to place, whether it was going hunting or fishing or from station to station, and my father would always, he'd start whistling and start whistling, you know, don't. Okay, which march is that? See, I think that's the 2nd Armored Division march. Okay, and then another Russian march, and this and that, and you know, we'd mix it in with Justin Wilson and Bert Nye and these little comedy things, and he loved all that stuff. And so Les Mis, which he also loved, it just
you didn't pick a march, you picked Les Mis.
Yeah, because it has that element. It's sad and it's a little schmaltzy, of course. It's been one of the most popular, you know, musicals of all time. But it also has that that beautiful part at the end where it where the folks come in during the French Revolution, you know, and you know, the marching and so
yep.
forth. And also another sort of aside is I have a sister that's a Benedictine nun who's also featured in the book, because the woman who founded her monastery in Litchfield County, Connecticut, was a nun in occupied France in the 30s and 40s. Mm. And that monastery, which was outside of Paris, was liberated by the Third Army. So she came back in response to that, founded an abbey here. And then 30 years later, my sister walked in as a rebel Dartmouth grad.
And she became a nun. Still there. Yep.
As a rebel college student. Yeah.
So coming full circle here with the music,
coming full circle.
Right?
So sometimes when I pick up my sister for the occasional visit home, I pick her up in Litchfield and we drive to Massachusetts. We listen to all this stuff. And Les Mis is one we often pop on there and are just roaring with excitement over our nostalgia for my father,
Who you remember so fondly.
Yeah, I love him, and I hope he's up there smiling. And I didn't write the book for him, but in a sense, maybe I did.
Mm. Benjamin Patton, thank you so much. Thanks
thank
for sharing.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Song Is You, produced and hosted by Bonnie Grice. The executive producer is Linda Lippman. The engineers include Charles DeMontebello and Ethan Donaldson at CDM Studios in New York City, and Kyle Lynch and Matt Cooper at Peconic Public Broadcasting in Southampton, New York. To learn more and hear some sample shows, check out our website, thesongisyou.org. The Song Is You is a division of BLG Productions. Continuing adventures in public media.